Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. How's your breathing? I often get sent books about breathing exercises to improve breathing. But what about the health of your lungs? That's always a good place to start when considering how deeply and well you're breathing. Yes, relaxation and mindfulness will improve your breathing, but maybe part of the problem is your lungs, which points to your nutrient status, your exposures, how much you exercise, and whether or not you're taking drugs. I always think that having an overview of what improves your health gives you increased choices, freedom, actually. So stay with us today as we explore the health of your lungs, what supports them, and what breaks them down. So now to our topic of the day, healthy lungs, and I'd like to let Jeffrey sort of lead off.
We each breathe somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,600 gallons of air each day, and all the stuff that goes with it. As I'm sure you know, the principal process here is to get oxygen into your body and to get carbon dioxide out. So I want to frame my discussion here of what's happening for lung health by talking about some diagnoses that are increasing worldwide, and those are asthma and what's called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Which, when I first came across this categorization, I thought, oh boy, another made-up disease. Let's see, we can't actually treat anything. Let's make something up and start fussing with it. This diagnosis, which of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, the acronym is COPID, actually it consists as principally chronic bronchitis and emphysema. So they've lumped those two diagnoses together. And as I read about this diagnosis, it actually makes some sense to put them together because the diagnosis is actually based on a physiological response, your ability to breathe, and more specifically, your ability to exhale. And I'll talk about what all of that means, but the really surprising thing is that this is a worldwide problem and that it is the sixth leading cause of death worldwide.
Wow.
So I'm although many of us are aware that asthma is on the rise and that is a very serious condition, particularly for children, I'm going to talk mostly about COPD just to get us into what's going on in our lungs and what can go wrong and how we prevent things from going wrong in our lungs. In somewhat of the spirit of canaries in the coal mine, people who suffer from asthma and COPD are really telling us that something's wrong in our environment that's causing them who are susceptible to succumb. One kind of side note is that asthma is really an increasing among children, but COPD is or was those diseases were looked at as diseases of aging, and that in fact is where the incidence occurs because the time that it takes for these diseases to develop is quite long. Because of principally four, we'll call them three environmental and one social cause. The environmental cause is the principal cause of this diagnosis or the problems that happen in your lungs are cigarette smoke, including secondhand smoke. Air pollution, in particular, fine particulates, and the portion of smog, which is oxidative. Sometimes smog or an active ingredient in it is called ozone. Ozone is three oxygen atoms bound together. But generally, there is a bunch of stuff in air pollution that's called reactive oxygen species, of which ozone is a principal component. It just means that it is highly oxidative, highly reactive. The third environmental effect is occupational exposures. One of the things that I found interesting from a study in Australia is, as you might expect, office workers have less of an incidence of these congestive obstructive pulmonary disease incidences, and while people in industry, who work in industry, mining and construction, where manufacturing, where there's a lot of both metallic and a lot of oxidative, a lot of basically pollution happening. It's also the case that service industries are almost as risky. Service industries such as remember that service industries incorporates things like people who work in hospitals, people who work in food manufacturing, I call it food manufacturing, and similar kinds of occupations that, although it's not hard labor, you are nevertheless exposed to dust and other air pollutants that particularly pollutants that come from, that have biological sources. So if you're at a fast food restaurant and you are cooking, the stuff that comes off of those deep fryers is volatilized, gets in the air, and you're breathing it. That's the sense that I make of that study. There's some controversy in the literature as to whether men or women are more susceptible to these kinds of diseases, and it's kind of a mixed bag. It looks like it's more circumstantial. One of the interesting, I won't call it interesting, one of the unfortunate consequences or in developing countries is that women who are at home, who tend fires that come from various biofuels, wood or coal, and if the house is not properly ventilated, they are subject to this, to these kinds of diseases more than men.
I just have a quick question, which is, it surprises me that office workers are not getting sick. What it means to me is that you actually have to have particulates of one sort or another. You have to actually have pieces of something in the air. But with the study that came out about laser printers and all the office equipment emitting stuff and creating ozone and all that, I'm surprised, though that I guess because offices with closed windows sort of have air conditioning. Well, except the air conditioning can be full of mold, too. But it sounds like it's particulates more than mold and chemicals that causes this.
The brief answer is yes. My speculation on this is that they found this because it was hard to tell just from what I saw from this from the study. Actually, it was a report on the study, not the study itself. I couldn't get my hands on the study as to how they, put people in each bin, as to what exactly they were exposed to. And again, this is in Australia, and it's hard. I do not know how big an issue of sick building syndrome and so on is. That's kind of a different illness, sickness response to polluted environment.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
It's a different form of pollution. It's particulates in particular and that's why, when we brought up the issue of nanotechnology, that's one of the reasons people are concerned about nanotechnology and also, in terms of some of these pesticides that are being sprayed and stuff, there's particulate in these things that are getting into the lungs.
It is, again, this classification of reactive oxygen species, which sounds like something that's made up, but it is exactly what it is. It's a species, it's a kind of molecule that is very reactive.
It's when oxygen goes bad.
When oxygen goes bad, when it wears a leather coat.
And smokes and wears
sunglasses.
Hangs
out on the corner, drives a convertible,
okay.
And you wouldn't want it to marry your daughter.
I
mentioned that we have, there are three principal exposures that affect risk of these diseases. And the fourth social cause is there's this nice gradient that the lower you are in the social hierarchy, the more likely you are to contract one of these illnesses. And in particular, even though the conventional literature pounds away on the fact that smoking is the biggest cause, non-smokers get this too. And in fact, I saw one study that said that the risk for African American men who are non-smokers is way out of proportion to other demographics.
So we assume that stress is a factor in developing this condition.
Yes. In fact, oxidative stress is the principal cause of these diseases, and I'll discuss how all of that works, because it actually creates a degenerative cycle, a vicious cycle of once weakness happens in the lungs, it produces oxidative stress of its own.
One other small thing is that what we do know that children in polluted environments people who are living close to poverty are living in Superfund sites and stuff that haven't been cleaned up, where there's a lot of pollution, and these kids are much more likely to get asthma. So it isn't just particulates, it's also chemical exposure.
Well, that's, I was going to mention at the end, I can mention it now. The literature is, there's kind of a mix as to whether having asthma is a risk factor, puts you at greater risk of having one of these lung diseases, the COPID.
The stuff that I saw wasn't drawing conclusions. I was looking at what works, what doesn't work in treating these people, who gets it. But the treatments and the things that affect people with asthma and people with COPD are almost identical. There are some small differences, but it's very similar, the sort of nutrient problems and all the rest of it, which I'll go over when you're done.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to cover the COPID is that no one's really, well, we haven't talked about it. We have talked about asthma.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
And in terms of what's going on in your lungs, there's a lot that's similar. So what is going on in your lungs takes a little anatomy. Your lungs, your breathing apparatus starts at your nose and mouth, goes down through your trachea, it's in your neck, and right below your neck you have bronchi and bronchioles. And at the end of those branches are what are called alveoli. So this kind of has the structure of a grapevine. You have a thick branch, goes down to little smaller branches, to little branch, and then at the end of it, there's these little clusters of little, actually in Latin, alveoli means belly. I thought it had meant grape, but means a small belly, small hollow place, which is exactly what it is. And the alveoli is where all the action happens in terms of breathing. They are basically a skin of epithelial cells, one cell thick, that's wrapped in, think of a little grape that's got a wrapping of small blood vessels. And on the air side of that epithelium is a surfactant. Surfactant is just a chemical that helps the carbon dioxide go out and the oxygen go in. Of course, there's other stuff that comes out and other stuff that comes in, but those are the principal ones that we're concerned with here. And the surfactant is a phospholipid we've talked about the role of phospholipids before in terms of maintaining cells and so on. And essentially what happens is your lungs, those alveoli, have a way of communicating with your brainstem so that when there's a lot of carbon dioxide coming out, there's a signal that's sent to your brainstem that says, breathe more deeply. Same thing is true when oxygen gets low. There's not enough oxygen in your lungs, you get a signal that goes by way of your aorta that feeds your heart and tells your brainstem, breathe more or yawn.
Yawning is for getting more air. That's what yawning is. Yawning is looking for more air.
So this whole process is to take care of what's called oxidative respiration, which is what happens in all the cells of your body, which your circulatory system is connected to. So there's which all the cells in your body use oxygen to produce energy, and they give off carbon dioxide. The hemoglobin in your blood, which I think we all are familiar with, that carries
red blood cells carries
oxygen to the other cells in your body. They use the oxygen, make energy, give off carbon dioxide, and then the carbon dioxide is carried back to your lungs. Now, what's interesting is hemoglobin has a role in carrying carbon dioxide back to your lungs. What's also interesting is that most of the carbon dioxide, which when in water, which is what your blood is, turns into an acid. It's mild acid, carbolic acid, that is not good for you. And your body has a way of turning that into bicarbonate that makes it possible to move through your system. An interesting thing is that your kidneys are involved in controlling that acidity. And in fact, I had a conversation yesterday with a friend who I told him what I was doing the show on. We were doing the show on this week, and he said, "Oh, well, several years ago, for 3 years running, I had bronchitis, you know, every winter."
It's worth mentioning that he's a landscaper too, so yes. he's breathing dirt.
Yeah. And he went to see an acupuncturist who said, "Oh, we need to treat your kidneys." And it was a 10-day course, but after day two, his bronchitis was gone and it never returned. So there's a handshake here between your lungs, your circulatory system, and your kidneys that is extremely important.
Yeah, there's one other thing that's worth mentioning here. When you were talking about the alveoli, I'm probably saying that wrong, and you were talking about their structure, the other important thing to remember, and this would go back to the issue of whether or not chemicals are irritating to the lungs, which we would have to think yes, because if you inhale something, it's going to end up in your bloodstream. So if you inhale a chemical,
yes,
that's one way beyond touching it with your skin. Inhaling it will also carry it into your bloodstream. And then, of course, as you just pointed out, it will get to your kidneys and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Circulation and kidneys.
So the way your lungs and so on work, it's built to protect you. It is built to protect you from inhaling stuff. That's bad, and we have all experienced that. Produces mucus. I just got a note that I can't read.
Oh, okay, never mind. I was trying to tell you that we need to ID, but finish your thought.
Okay. So we have lots of ways of getting rid of stuff that our body doesn't want, and we are all familiar with those. But once something is in the gas phase, it's gaseous, it gets all the way to the alveoli, the really important operating part of your lungs.
You're listening to a show with Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett. Jeff Fawcett, predominantly right now, PhD, discussing healthy lungs. We're talking about the actual physics and physiology of what goes on in the lungs, especially in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is kind of a large garbage pail diagnosis. Not really a garbage pail, but it's for a number of, you know, chronic bronchitis and emphysema and things like that. We did talk a bit about asthma, but anyway, that's what we're talking about today. Let's get back to our discussion of healthy lungs. We've been discussing the relationship between the lungs, the kidneys, and circulation.
Cigarette smoke, air pollution, exposures at work. In addition to the stress from social inequality, these all promote oxidative stress, which affects your lungs, the lungs in a particular way. chronic bronchitis is an inflammation of the airways, and so has a similarity to asthma. Very often, chronic bronchitis will result in spasms that are similar to an asthma attack. And over the long run, what happens with that inflammation is that the tissues are affected and it becomes stiff. The pipes do not respond as they once did. They are not elastic. Further down in the lungs, emphysema is a disease of the alveoli. What happens there is the oxidative stress over long exposures, because your body is not able to clear that stuff over the long run, the mesh that holds the cells together is affected, is in fact broken down. And tobacco smoke is particularly nasty with this. There's a substance that's in a lot of epithelial cells, or that's around epithelial cells, called elastin. And it is just as it sounds, it's elastic. It's what makes it possible for blood vessels to expand and contract easily, and it makes it possible for alveoli to expand and contract easily and let gases in and so on. There are a number of substances in tobacco which affect a biochemical called alpha-1 antitrypsin. What antitrypsin does is it prevents the breakdown of elastin, because it affects another enzyme which does break down the elastin. Sounds a little complicated, but it's kind of like traffic cop. It says, nope, can't, no more, that's enough, can't break down anymore, because your body cycles through that mesh that holds cells together. What tobacco smoke does is it clobbers antitrypsin. So it means that you have enzymes that break down the elastin on high alert. Yippee! Nobody's going to stop us now. And what then happens is the alveoli kind of bunch together, and instead of being a nice little bunch of grapes, it's now this big ball. Now, sorry to visit some physics on you, but once that happens, your ability to exchange gases becomes much less efficient. And it becomes much harder for you to breathe, because it's harder for you to exhale. That sounds kind of counterintuitive, but that's the signaling that happens that tells you to breathe. So if you get too much carbon dioxide in the alveoli, what your brainstem is going to hear from your lungs is, get this stuff out and get some oxygen in here. You're not going to be able to do that, because one of the further things that happens when you have this inflammatory process going on in your lungs is that the muscles that control your breathing, I'm sure you all know that it isn't actually your lungs that are doing the expanding and contracting, but your diaphragm, that becomes inflamed too and becomes less responsive. So you have this process which mechanically makes it, in emphysema, makes it mechanically more or less efficient gas exchange in your lungs. So it also, because it is an inflammatory process, it produces this whole list of very nasty things going on, which creates a downward spiral, which creates oxidative stress of its own that your lungs then respond to, which then creates more oxidative stress, and down you go, and you lose lung function. So this process is claimed to be irreversible. I'm always skeptical when official science says this, but I haven't seen anything that of cases of restructuring the lungs in cases of emphysema or bronchitis. Yeah.
Well, what you're describing, as you said, are physical changes or mechanical changes.
Yes.
And if you get a really bad bronchitis and you wrap yourself up in warm clothing especially if you're fighting like a pneumonia or something, if you feel like you're just starting to get sick and your lungs are doing that thing, and you wrap yourself up and you bundle up and you keep really warm and you take a walk that's as vigorous as you can take without wearing yourself out, just a short one around the block or something, and you do that every day. Or if you're feeling reasonably well, you walk up a hill and you actually push your lung function a little bit. If you're just newly sick like that or something, sometimes you can avoid getting a full pneumonia or a bronchitis by challenging the lungs and oxygenating yourself and getting your lungs to start working, just as you can rebuild lungs function after an illness. But what you're talking about is a long process, especially with COPD.
Very long.
It takes a long time for this to happen. And after it's happened, I know, because I've worked with emphysema patients, that there are some things you can do to help on
yes.
a nutrient level so that they feel better, but I don't know if you can turn it around. But you and I are both saying we don't know. It isn't that we know that you can't. It's just that when you're looking at physical changes, I mean, the brain can change, you know, when the physical structures in the brain change and you do some work on that, it can change back. So maybe the lung can be affected, but it does sound like a real challenge at that point.
Yeah, it's not clear what's happened, because you've got not only the change in elasticity, but in what's called the extracellular matrix, which is collagen that holds cells together, and that stiffens up.
Yeah,
it is a response to oxidative stress, which is similar to what happens in other parts of the body and when it's subjected to oxidative stress.
So you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we're discussing the health of your lungs. Right now we're talking about how your lungs work, the handshake between the lungs and the kidneys and the circulatory system. We are also going to talk about what sorts of nutrient deficiencies put you at risk, what kind of behaviors and things that you're exposed to. We've already discussed some, but we'll get more into that. And talk specifically some more as we go on about some solutions and some protections for the lungs. Once again, Your Own Health and Fitness, Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, taking a brief break from Healthy Lungs. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman in studio with Jeff Fawcett, and we are discussing healthy lungs. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Get a free stream of this week's show and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do it by email. It's admin, @yourownhealthandfitness.org. Did you want to say more about the kidneys and the lungs? I mean, the place that I always think of the kidneys and lungs is that in elderly patients, and some people get this when they're not so elderly, unfortunately, they get congestive heart.
Mm-hmm.
And congestive heart is related to this as well.
Oh, yes.
Do you want to explain?
what happens in the kidneys, essentially, as I mentioned earlier, is your body's trying to get rid of the carbon dioxide from cells, from cell metabolism. And the way that it carries that carbon dioxide around is principally in the form of bicarbonate, which is in an chemical equilibrium with carbonic acid,
It's alkalinizing.
No, it's an acid. It's acidifying.
The bicarbonate is.
The bicarbonate is.
Yeah, no,
is,
I was talking about
is alkalinizing.
Yeah.
And so one of the processes that happens with your kidneys is there's an exchange of there's also hydrogen atoms, which hydrogen atoms is what makes things acidic. So your body wants to get rid of that, and it goes through a process where it exchanges bicarbonate and nitrogen for sodium. So it creates urea in urine. So the ability to excrete this stuff, to get it out in your urine, is extremely important for maintaining that balance that is able to offload the carbon dioxide from your lungs and maintain, because the other signal that your body takes is pH, the acidity of your body as to how much you should breathe. So your kidneys and your lungs are talking to each other, and they're talking to each other through the medium of the carbon dioxide in your blood. So maintaining that healthy metabolism in the kidneys to form urea and excrete it is an essential part of lung health, odd as that may sound.
So do you want to explain what congestive heart is, or do you want me to do it? But go ahead.
Well, all yours.
Oh. When the kidneys... And it's kind of... Well, it sounds to me from the way you were just saying it that we've got a round robin. So yeah. What happens is that as the handshake between the lung and the kidneys, it functions less well because the lungs are getting damaged for some reason. Then the kidneys, although this can happen also with the kidneys going for some reason. If somebody's been,
yes.
A lot of elderly patients are on an enormous number of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have difficult side effects that include damage to the kidneys and sometimes the liver. The liver obviously can't clear this stuff, and then it may damage the kidneys too. So if the kidneys get damaged for some reason, what happens is that you can't eliminate enough of the fluid in your body, and there's a fluid buildup in the lungs, and it's the lungs being full of liquid that tanks your heart, that causes your heart to fail. It isn't, you know, the heart... But it's also true that if the heart is failing, if the heart is weak and it's not pumping enough blood, then the lungs are not getting enough blood and enough oxygen, and then the lungs begin to fill with fluid for that reason, and then the kidneys go. So there's this, it's I don't know what the chicken and egg deal is with this. There's probably a lot of different threads that can be pulled to cause this sweater to unravel.
Oh, well, certainly in terms of the conventional literature, that emphysema is an almost certain risk, it almost certainly develops eventually into congestive heart failure.
Ouch.
And into kidney failure. And the congestive heart failure, congestive heart failure doesn't lead to emphysema, but certainly emphysema is the other way around. I haven't seen anything in terms of bronchitis because that's further up in the air passages. But that's an inflammatory process that, in principle, could lead to further damage down the lungs.
Did you have more that you wanted to...
I just wanted to make the point that, again, as I said at the beginning, that I wanted to talk about this COPD diagnosis as of rising concern, and particularly among older people. I have a friend who is who is working with some researchers at UC San Francisco, having been diagnosed with this stuff. So it's on the rise, but asthma is equally important. And I just wanted to say that the actual processes here are in the same family The difference with asthma is an allergy, is an allergic response.
Can be, yeah.
As opposed to simply a response to environmental stress. But it's a stress on your lungs. It is inflammatory. Your body's going to respond with its antioxidant response to reduce that stress. So we've got similar processes going on here, and they are both environmentally caused.
Well, and also psychosocial stress too, because children do develop asthma when they are under chronic stress, chronic stress or trauma. They often will develop asthma as well.
And another interesting exposure fact, as I said, air pollution is an effect, but another way to slice this is that for both asthma and for COPD, you are at less risk in rural areas than in urban areas.
Because of the particulate in the air? I mean, there's particulate in the air in agricultural areas, too.
Different, agricultural. Agricultural. I mean, Fresno is the asthma capital of the United States.
Yeah, but you're talking about rural life, not so much,
rural as opposed to agricultural.
Yeah, because then it's industrial again.
Yes.
So do you want to say something before I sort of start talking about various things? Do you want to say something about the way that asthma and COPD are treated very often because of the inflammatory process is that people are given in steroid inhalers?
Yeah.
And since you're looking at a process that has, it's hard to separate the mind and the body. The research that I looked at was discussing the stressors of having COPD or having asthma and the effect that the stress has on the body and how it breaks the body down and people become sometimes very thin and malnourished. And they can't breathe, they can't exercise, so they lose their robustness. So if you've got, say, an example of a kid who's under stress and trauma and maybe has additional exposures on top of it, beginning to develop asthma, and you give him a steroid inhaler, you're decreasing his native ability, his internal, right. his endogenous right. ability to produce his own glucocorticoid steroids, which are the body's natural way of decreasing inflammation. And since stress occurs in a wave, a kind of peak and valley,
yes.
there is supposed to be, along with a large gush of these glucocorticoid steroids, which is what cortisone is a synthetic version of one of these, as it goes up to deal with the stressful situation, there's supposed to be, at some point, a drop in these hormones, the production of these hormones, and a trough where people would naturally feel tired but would normally, supposed to curl up and rest. And, of course, in our modern society, people don't sometimes have an opportunity or they don't even think of resting. They're afraid to rest. But that's supposed to happen so that there's a wave pattern to the production of these hormones because they have a destructive effect on other parts of the body if they're high for a long time. So you start dumping a bunch of synthetic glucocorticoid steroids into somebody, you will reduce the specific area of inflammation that it's touching will get reduced if you put it on, shoot it into a knee, or if you have knee inflammation, or you breathe it into your lungs. But downstream, you're destroying and interfering with your native production of these hormones, and there are other risks to using steroids. And they also appear not to work. Go ahead.
Oh, no.
No, I'm done.
Finished? Okay. I came across a research article that for emphysema patients showed that giving them antioxidants was actually better than giving them steroids because the argument in the article was that those steroids may actually make the situation worse because it, oddly enough, it reduces the inflammation. The problem with emphysema is the oxidative stress, not the inflammation per se. Inflammation is a problem with bronchitis. And what you want to do is throw a bunch of antioxidants.
Just throw them
at them and then run out the door. Get out as fast as you can. to reduce the oxidative stress process that is self-perpetuating that's going on in the lungs. That's what you want to calm down.
Yeah, you want to go to the cause, the root cause.
Because inflammation, after all, we always talk about or tend to talk about inflammation as this bad thing. Oh, inflammation, it's bad. Well, inflammation is part of your immune response. The reason you have inflammation is so that the materials that will fight an infection or something bad going on in your system can get to the site of that of what's being attacked.
You can overquell inflammation. There's no question about it. But you should tell that to somebody who can't breathe. You know, I mean, people who can't breathe, who have asthma attacks, and you say, don't use your inhaler. You have to work on these things before you start trying to wean them off an inhaler. So I'm not saying that I don't understand why people resort to inhalers. My goodness, if you can't breathe, you're also producing a lot of stress. So you know. But the idea is to work on it from the standpoint of what things work. So what I did was I looked at research on working with asthma and COPD, what kind of research was done with nutrients. Since, as Jeffrey said, it's clear from the literature that you've got a oxidative problem happening, that the physical changes that he described, which are different in asthma, bronchitis, and emphysema, so they're going to be different in each case. They still have in common the development of these of oxidative stress causing inflammation. So treating with antioxidants is clearly a better way to go. Now, what was interesting about looking at the literature was that the only thing that I could find any research on was using N-acetylated cysteine, which is one, you know, good antioxidant, but it isn't the best, in my opinion. The thing that they're trying to do is get the detoxification pathways to produce glutathione. So they're trying to increase glutathione levels, which is how your liver detoxifies. So, you know, me with my rolling it back and looking at the source kind of thing makes me think that along with the risk factor of your exposures, you're also looking at risk factors that include nutrient deficiencies, problems with methylation, which is what goes ahead and pushes your detoxification pathways to make glutathione so the liver can work. So the liver is clearly a problem in here, too. And obviously malnutrition. These are all risk factors for increasing the risk of respiratory failure and stuff. Some other things that can move this along and cause problems is that they saw, obviously, smoking is, you know, a no-no. It really is true that it damages the lungs. It damages the heart almost more than it damages the lungs, which is also going to affect the lungs, as we just found out. So one group of studies was looking at the effect of people, how many people got sick, had COPD, who were smokers, who had been eating processed meat products, you know, these foods with nitrates in them, smoked meat, cured meat products, but we're talking about the ones that contain nitrates. And those people had much higher level, had COPD, had inflammation in the lungs, much worse than people who didn't eat those, even if they were smoking. Now, what that means is that damaged fats in general and the ratio of nutritional fats is going to be important. Remember that your lung surfactant is made of phospholipids, as is your brain, and phospholipids contain cholesterol, among other things. So the ratio of the fats you eat and how natural they are and how undamaged and non-rancid they are, no fake fats, no damaged fats, no overcooked fats, no... sort of, that's going to be an issue too. So that's why I think what we see often in the studies as being helpful is adding in, there are tons of studies, adding in fish oils. And I suspect the reason is because fish oils help to maintain a good balance. You don't make fish oils in your body. These are essential fatty acids. You have to get them in. I suppose you could also use flax oil or hemp seed oil if you're not a diabetic, because you can't convert the linoleic acid to long-chain omegas. So the fish oils are good because they're already converted. But the reason I think the fish oils are helping, nobody says this in the studies, they just look to see if they work, and they seem to help, is both because they maintain a healthy balance between the ubiquitous omega-6s, which are vegetable oils, and the omega-9s, which come from animal fats and things like that, with the omega-3s, because your degree of inflammation is going to depend on a good balance favoring the omega-3s with these 3, 6, and 9. This is why I don't recommend that people take a mixture of oils. I suggest that you just eat your foods and take some omega-3s, because those are the ones you're going to have a harder time getting into you, because they're not so easy to get in your body. But they're mildly immunosuppressive, which in this type of situation may be helpful. They do, on the basis of being mildly immunosuppressive, lower inflammation. But they also, I was struck by this when I was listening to Jeff talk about the inflexibility of the structures of the lungs and the tissues and everything becoming stiff and inflexible. That another thing is that if you have a good balance of polyunsaturated omega-3s to your saturates and other fats, your cells are going to be softer and more flexible. Another thing that's, you know, obviously, as I said, damaged fats, antioxidant status, nutrient deficiencies, malnutrition, and smoking, and physical stress. And the physical stress affects the exercise capacity. So there's a kind of back and forth between physical stress and then physical stress affecting you to the point where you can't exercise. But exercise also decreases your stress. So exercise in whatever capacity you have is helpful, unless you are so far along on this road. If you're a severe emphysema sufferer, it's going to be very difficult for you. So I don't know the answer to that, but I always think that exercise, to the degree that you can do it without, you know, where you can recover, where you feel better when you finish and you're not exhausted and you can recover, is going to increase your lung capacity. Incidentally, you're listening to your own health and fitness. Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and Lena Berman talking about healthy lungs. So the antioxidants help. Specific nutrients like fatty acids and minerals help. One study that was done in Brazil in 2006, which was most of the studies were kind of duh, but this was an interesting study. It's a little bit duh, but it's still a very smart study to do. They gave L-carnitine to patients with COPD, and it increased their exercise capacity, which increased inspiratory muscle strength and walking test tolerance. So there's an indication that if you boost mitochondrial function in patients whose lungs are already inflamed and somewhat changed from this disease process, that they will still now be able to move around and walk and exercise, which will affect their lung capacity. So there is some hope. So one answer to what we said of can you reverse this is using high doses, you know, somewhere between maybe 2 and 4 grams of L-carnitine, maybe 2,000 twice a day. This can be taken with meals or away from meals. So these loading doses, a couple of grams twice a day, increased exercise capacity, which helped people to feel better and things to work better. Several studies discuss magnesium, because magnesium is a vasodilator, and it improves expiratory flow and relaxes the bronchial tissues. So people who were given magnesium had less hospitalizations. Potassium also helps, and there you have the potassium sodium pump, which is affecting your adrenals and your kidneys and all of that. Zinc is chronically low in patients whose lungs are inflamed, and increasing that also helps. And then the people who wrote this study said, but it took more than 8 weeks. Their study was 8 weeks. And, well, all nutrients take longer than 8 weeks to work. You're resaturating the body with missing things, and it takes a while then for the body to begin to heal. Coenzyme Q10 increases muscle strength. This works synergistically with carnitine. It increases your muscle energy, your mitochondrial energy and muscle strength. So it's terribly important in people with damaged lungs and lung symptoms. And we are finding now that taking very large doses of CoQ10, large doses meaning between maybe 2 to 500 or 600 milligrams a day, broken up into 3 doses, CoQ10 can be purchased in a pure powder, and for people with sensitive stomachs, I usually recommend getting it that way and mixing it with your favorite oil, like sesame oil or an oil you don't mind the taste of. Just a few drops of oil with your dry powder will make it easier to take. It absorbs in water. So CoQ10, very important. Vitamin A deficiencies are very, very common, and I might say that your common antioxidants are A, E, and C, and they are all important. Vitamin C is a natural antihistamine, so it will reduce allergic response in asthmatics and in people with COPD. Vitamin A has been used. There's a protocol for using high doses of vitamin A with emphysema, starting with, do I have the actual dosing here? I think it's something like you take 75,000 IUs for a month, and then you go down to 50,000 IUs for a month, and then eventually you go to 25,000 IUs as a maintenance dose. So that's a fairly high dose of vitamin A. When you take a high dose of vitamin A, you also need to make sure you're getting plenty of vitamin D, like dog. There's a handshake between these two vitamins. Vitamin D is not specifically for the lungs, but vitamin A and D have a handshake. And obviously, vitamin A is not to be taken in patients with liver failure, just because the body has a hard time getting rid of it. This is not a problem with most people whose lungs are affected. Methylation, as I said, is going to be very important in people with lung problems, because glutathione reduces the inflammation, and you can't make glutathione unless you're methylating. And those nutrients are all of your B vitamins, but specifically, and this came up in all the literature I saw, B6, B12, folic acid, and either dimethylglycine. Actually, dimethylglycine might even be better for lung patients than trimethyl, because dimethyl seems to affect mitochondrial function. So dimethylglycine, DMG. Diets that are high in carbohydrates require more oxygen to metabolize. So I've seen people who are eating comfort foods because they don't feel well, because they have emphysema or asthma or something, and they're eating a lot of carbohydrates and starches and fun foods. And when you switch them to a diet that's lower in these starchy foods, they have an easier time breathing. So the sort of hunter-gatherer style diet, although veggies and fruits are very helpful because they're alkalinizing, they're cooling, and they have a lot of carotenoids. In addition, they did studies with men, not women, just men, and found that people with lung problems were low in testosterone, and when they gave them testosterone, they got better. There's so many reasons why that may be so. Jeffrey, you had something. Is it quick? Because I'm almost...
It's very quick. I want to mention a piece of research I just saw before I came down for the show on vitamin C and vitamin E, not as antioxidants, but as cofactors in the production of collagen, which is what the cellular matrix is made from. So having C and E in the diet is going to help keep the lungs together.
Okay. Asthma, a couple of other risk factors for asthma is food allergies and food additives. Food additives trigger a lot of asthma. Also low thyroid and obviously pollutions. In asthma, 8 to 10% of episodes were drug-induced. So if you're taking a drug for a long time or a variety of drugs, they may be causing asthma, particularly non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, aspirin, beta blockers, chemotherapy, and antibiotics. Especially with asthma, there's a lot of studies showing B12 deficiencies. The same thing, fish oils, CoQ10. The vitamins are the same. Another thing that helps with any kind of lung problem is a Chinese fungus called cordyceps. CORDYCEPS, cordyceps. Usually comes in a tablet of 1,000 milligrams, two of those a day. DGL licorice, think darn good licorice. DGL licorice is an anti-inflammatory. It's an expectorant. It's an antiviral. It's emollient. It's very good for the lungs. Sometimes people have these lung problems because they have an unresolved infection of some sort. Various herbs that help, although you can do this kind of research yourself, but the ones that come up a lot are loquat, marshmallow, mullein, slippery elm. If you have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, there are some homeopathic remedies that are recommended by various people. If you have a dry cough, bryonia, if the cough, you have to cough a lot to get anything to come up, and you're irritated and possibly constipated. Hepersulfurius calcarium, if you're hoarse and it gets worse in the cold, you lose your voice in the cold. Spongia is for a croupy cough and you're hoarse with heart palpitations. And stannium, S-T-A-N-N-U-M, is for violent coughing and green mucus that's worse in the evening. There are flower remedies that work. Holly, if you're angry. Hornbeam with fatigue. Impatience, if you're impatient and nervous and hyper-aroused. Minulus, M-I-N-U-L-U-S, if you're fearful and shy. Exercise, as I said, stay warm. Don't do anything that pushes you into feeling exhausted or collapsing. But walking when you're warm can help, but not vigorously if you have a fever. Build capacity slowly. Steam, in some conditions, will reduce inflammation. I don't think it works well for emphysema. For asthma, the homeopathics are antimonium tartaricum for wheezing, arsenicum album for anxious cold asthmatic patients, chamomilla if the asthma attack's triggered by anger and the person's irritable, pulsatilla if it starts with an upper respiratory infection. You can also put essential oils in steam, lavender, pine, rose, peppermint, if you're not using homeopathics. So that gives you some vague idea of how to begin to treat any of these things when you're in a chronic state of inflammation. The main thing is to boost the detox pathways, get the glutathione up. NAC is not bad, but I prefer alpha-lipoic acid, probably in doses of 250 milligrams twice a day. The CoQ10, as I mentioned, just the A, E, and C, vitamin C throughout the day. So quelling the infection with the antioxidants is going to make a remarkable amount of difference. So that about covers it for lung health. You've been listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature, a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do so by email, admin, @yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett and Lena Berman. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.